You're listening to the Bungo Cast. I'm your host, Bungo Man. Currently, it is 81 degrees with a wind chill of 80. I'm joined today by JT Alexander. JT, how are you?
I'm doing good, man. How are you?
Great. So the reason I wanted to bring you on to the show today was to talk about homeschooling. My understanding is that you homeschool your children and you have pretty strong opinions about schooling in general, in particular homeschooling. I'm curious, you know, the first thing I wanted to ask is why should you homeschool your children?
I think I can describe myself as possibly the country's biggest advocate for abolition of the public school system. So that is an accurate summary to say that I'm pro homeschooling. there's a mountain of reasons. Every conversation we could talk for hours, and every 20-30 minutes we're going to stumble upon another reason why the public school system sucks and you should homeschool your kids instead. It's such a massive question that it's almost a challenge to find where to begin.
Well, I guess let's start with what was the first thing that made you realize that public schools are not so good? I'm sure there was probably, you know, a lot of little things over the years, but what was the moment where the light bulb went off and you were like, ooh, I don't want to do this to my kids?
Well, I went to public school. I'm a product of that system, so I'd say that definitely was part of it. So I was a teen parent. I had my first child. I was still very young, really. And at the time, like, I knew I hated the public school system and I hated having grown up in it, but I didn't really consider it for my daughter at that point yet, because I was still kind of at the presumption of like, homeschool kids are kind of weird. They don't socialize enough. I was still kind of buying into that line of thinking. But ultimately what caused us to really pull the trigger on it was, when my daughter was about 3 or 4, I was trying to make her learn how to read, and she was being stubborn and lazy and just refusing to try. And I hate that character trait. So I said, we are going to sit here until you read Are You My Mother completely by yourself. And we did that. And we sat there for like 3-4 hours for her to read the entirety of a book by herself. And from that moment, she has been a very voracious reader. And so by first grade, she did end up going to public school for kindergarten and first grade. But by first grade, she was reading The Hobbit while in class they're reading Dr. Seuss one word at a time. And I just found that to be an unacceptable level of holding her back. So my wife and I talked about it for a long time, and we talked about the fact that we hated public school, that we knew it was miserable to go to as a kid, that it, frankly, as far as just the knowledge of the teachers, there's only a select number of subjects that I would say the teacher probably can teach better than I can. I'm thinking chemistry, advanced mathematics, that kind of thing. Sure, they definitely outmatch me there. But when it comes to history, the English language, simple math, the fact I'm not spending 30 minutes of an hour-long class telling kids to shut up and sit down automatically makes me a more effective teacher. So that was kind of the decision point. That was back in 2017 or so we made that decision. And so we've had a number of years to really reflect and think about this and look at the differences. And yeah, now there's just a massive laundry list of reasons I find this superior.
So do you do most of the homeschooling? For your daughter, or is it kind of a combination of you and your wife, or and how did you make that decision, you know, as far as who handles what?
My wife does most of it, and that's because she's the one who's home more. Because we became adults during the kind of the peak of the recession and everything just being expensive as hell, when it came time for my daughter to like start going to daycare and stuff, the cost of it was more than my wife could make, or effectively so. She'd be working a job basically just to pay for daycare. And we were like, why would we do that when you can just spend time with the kids? So my wife has never really worked the whole time we've been married, like a couple of times, not for very long. So she's the one who does most of the teaching, and then I kind of come in to pinch hit for like some heavy hitting subjects. Like I do all of the social study because that's like my specialty is social studies. My approach to helping out with the other subjects is more of a kind of unschooling thing where I'm not sitting down with my daughter teaching her, you know, literature and art and history. She will learn. Sorry, I should have said art and language history to be specific. General history, we absolutely are sitting down. But yeah, so she's really big into art. She's a big reader. I want her to learn the history of the arts because I think that's just, it's fascinating and informative and helps you understand a lot of what's going on with the art fields that you're interested in. And so with that, she'll sit down with my wife and do like lessons on language. And then we have her in like a private art class she'll go to, and she'll learn how to do the drawing and that kind of thing. But then my approach as a supplement is more of an unschool thing where if we're just going about our business in the day and the subject comes up, I'm going to explain a bunch of stuff to her. It's kind of like impromptu lecture, if you will. And I find this to be interesting and very effective because when I was in school in like English the language arts, reading, that kind of thing, there was a lot of being told how to interpret stuff, but not a whole lot of actual thinking and interpretation going on. You know, you're being told that the curtains are blue because of this and that, and all you can think of is, I don't care. Like, nobody finds that kind of storytelling interesting when you are being told bit by bit what everything means. But if my daughter reads all of Charles Dickens and then we're going about our day and something reminds her of it, that opens up a discussion for us to talk about what is Dickens talking about here? What's the lesson from Oliver Twist that applies to this thing we're encountering in the world today? That kind of thing. And I find that has been very effective for my daughter. She's out here like, she's making ancient Greek philosophy and Chinese history jokes that like nobody gets but me around her, and I find it hilarious because she's already like nerding out at the internet autist level while also just being like a normal person. And so I think that that's a very positive result.
So do you find that having your kid being homeschooled, that it forces you as a parent to be a little more creative around how you teach them things? You know, because I think, you know, any good parent is going to be teaching their children, at various points in their life. When your kids are in public school, you kind of outsource a lot of that. So you found that like you've had to put more thought into some of what you were just describing, like maybe not necessarily planning out that, oh, you're going to start talking about some aspect of history with your daughter, but just sort of kind of going through what you might do if the subject gets brought up, or I'm curious, you know, what level of planning you have, you know, when it comes to the more unschooling aspect of it.
So when it comes to the formal lessons that my wife is giving, that's usually planned out. We will buy individual curriculum sometimes to, I want to say fill the day, but to give you material to work with that doesn't rely on you coming up with everything. And then we'll also come up with things, you know, in addition to our own that we want to do. So say her reading lesson might be to, I don't know, read one piece of classic literature or something. And we'll decide, I want you to also read this other one. That's something we can kind of plan to the extent of we want our child to have read this thing, but we're not planning out like, oh, I want you to read pages 1 through 45, and then I have a list of questions for you to answer kind of thing. And so when it comes to the unschooling half is probably an exaggeration. When it comes to the unschooling portion of this, it's more of what I think of as a traditional parental lesson and mentorship thing that people just got usually. Like John Adams, I don't think, was sitting down planning out lessons to give John Quincy. I think he just thought of things that occurred to him that would be good for his child to know. And that's kind of how I approach things.
Yeah, no, I like that. You know, it's the way I kind of look at homeschooling is that obviously, you know, schools in various forms have been around for, you know, a long time in different cultures. But when you look at how people learn historically, you know, it was mostly just by being around your parents and learning things from your parents. And there's something about that that I think is deeply ingrained in what it even means to be human. And I think, you know, a lot of how we approach education now, you know, and I like to draw pretty clear distinction between education and schooling. I think it discourages that. And I think that's largely to our detriment. I'm curious, what are some of the biggest challenges that you have faced in regards to homeschooling? A little bit of background about myself. I have an 18-month-old daughter, and you know, we haven't yet figured out exactly if she's going to be homeschooled or not. It, definitely not public school, but the private schools around here aren't super great, in my opinion, from what I've read. But you know, I'm just curious, you know, what have you had to deal with that when you first started down the path of homeschooling your daughter that you didn't think you would have to deal with, and how have you how have you figured that out?
I think the hardest thing has been standard parenting stuff that comes no matter what. So my wife and I had, I guess in hindsight, a kind of naive belief that a lot of the reasons that we had, you know, angsty teenage years was because of the environments we grew up in, which, I mean, granted, were terrible and I'm sure had negative effects on us. But my daughter has none of those things. And she still has a lot of the same kind of teenage angstiness. Not nearly as extreme, thank God, but it's still there. And it's kind of like, well, yeah, teenagers do that. That's normal teenager stuff, I guess. But I think naively, I thought public school probably, I mean, they absolutely contribute to it. But I think the contribution I had estimated and the contribution they actually produce is, there's a gap. I think I overestimated a little bit. And so you get this, like, I noticed with females in particular, you can have a lot of like daughter-mother like competition kind of thing. And I say competition, but it's not like my wife is engaging with it. It's like a child to mother thing. And I've seen other daughters do this, but like when your primary teacher is your mother and you have the natural teenage inclination to rebellion, that can be challenging. It can be very frustrating for a parent to like want to continue engaging with their child every day when they're being a pain in the butt. But I think that's pretty normal parenting. At this point, I kind of realize like that's just part of being teenagers. I do think the public school environment kind of fosters more rebellion against your parents because one, you're not around them very much. Two, they're not the primary teachers. And three, your primary influences are your peers who are people of the same age as you. And it's a situation of the blind leading the blind and thinking they're wise about it. So that's to say, there's a natural extent of teenage rebellion that can make homeschooling challenging. But I find the public school probably takes that natural extent and multiplies it several times. So that's probably the most challenging. The second most challenging, I think most people find, is just the finances. Now, that's to say, it's cheaper than people think, but you do need somebody who's not working full time. And so it's kind of a loss of wages rather than expense kind of thing. I will say that it's still not as bad as I think people lead themselves to believe. My wife and I come from poverty. We're both orphaned as teenagers. We had nothing, no extended family kind of thing. And we managed to homeschool while I was in law school, making less than median wage for one of the most expensive areas in the country on one income. So it can be done. It's about what you want and how bad you want it. And there is nothing I want more than to raise my kids properly. So that's how I overcome that.
Yeah, I think that's probably the most important thing is wanting to raise your kids correctly. after becoming a father, that became almost immediately apparent to me, where I think, you know, before it was, that was sort of a, you know, a more cerebral thing where you just like, okay, yeah, I guess that sounds like the correct answer. And that, but then like, you know, as soon as you hold your kid, like you feel that in your gut, in a way that you definitely did not before.
No, apparently that doesn't happen to everybody. I was chatting with the fathers group the other week, and the question came up. Somebody asked, like, "Hey, how many of y'all like felt this way the minute your kid was born?" And I was shocked how few people said yes, because like I was absolutely, the moment my daughter was born, like I would do anything for her. Like that was an instantaneous thing for me. Apparently, for a lot of dads, it can take like weeks to months to kick in, and that's wild. Like that's alien to me. I can't imagine it.
Yeah. Yeah, that does not match my experience at all. So kind of related, you know, to the last question is, what are some things about homeschooling that people have a tendency to think will be difficult, but in your experience aren't? I think the loss of income is definitely one of those things where I think, you know, a lot of people kind of might be a little bit right about, but what are some of the things that, you know, whenever you see, you know, a Twitter thread of people arguing about, you know, the pros and cons of homeschooling, what are some of the things where you're just like, that's not actually a problem?
The socialization thing, that has got to be the biggest myth by far, because some people think homeschool kids are weird because they encounter weird people in life and then they find out that person's homeschooled, and it's a form of confirmation bias, I think, and a sort of survivorship bias, although probably a different form that has some name, I don't know. So
it's the plane with red dots.
Yeah, it's you're gonna notice them because there's plenty of homeschool people out in the world that you don't know are homeschooled because you never asked. And you never asked because they weren't weird enough for you to think, oh, I should ask. Like it's a self-fulfilling theory because you've never taken contrary information. Socialization is very easy. And I think the reason you find those weird kids who are homeschooled is that, well, it's a selection thing about who is homeschooled. So prior to 2020, a lot of people who were homeschooled for religious reasons. Well, in America, the American Reformation has created a lot of crackpot religions, to be frank. And so you're going to end up with a lot of kids getting homeschooled by crackpots. That's not homeschooling that's the problem. That's the crackpots that are the problem. Otherwise, you'll end up with autistic and special needs kids who are being homeschooled because the public school can't provide what they need. Okay, again, that's the selection of they're already special needs, not because they were homeschooled. So then you get just the normal kids who are being homeschooled, and it's very easy to socialize them. So I'll say during the COVID years, it was challenging. That was because of COVID and where we lived. One, all of the lockdowns and stuff kind of made things difficult. Two, we lived in the Mid-Atlantic region, which I have found is basically a death sentence for social life, like genuine social connection. You can find a lot of superficial relationships there, but I very, very few like real relationships formed in the time I lived there. So, and during that period, yeah, my daughter's pretty lonely and isolated, but so was everybody at that point. Then we moved to a state that has a better sense of community, didn't have COVID policies to begin with, really, and they definitely don't have them now. And so she goes to church, she goes to vacation Bible school, she goes to private art class that we have, she goes to camps. She has more friends now than I ever did in my life. And we're not even leaning on all the options. She's not in any sports league. She's not in Girl Scouts. She's not in 4-H. She's not in any of the library programs. We're not in any homeschool co-op. We don't do any sort of homeschool group events. And she still has a complete social life now. So the theory or idea that people have that homeschool kids are weird and aren't properly socialized, like, that's just complete myth.
Yeah, I mean, I would say a lot of the more normal people that I've met as an adult end up being homeschooled. And I think you're right that there was a lot more of a selection effect there pre-COVID. But I think even then, I think the way like public school causes people to be socialized is I don't think it's good. You know, you kind of hinted on, you hinted earlier on something that I think is one of the things that I find to be one of the bigger problems with home or with public schooling. And that's, you know, how most of your peers are, you know, plus or minus 6 months of your age. You know, they're all within a 1 year band. And so you don't get a wide variety of people of different ages, you know, on a daily basis, except for, you know, authority figures who are, you know, to be frank, of wildly different degrees of quality. You know, I had some teachers in public school that were very good and some that were very, very bad. And so if that's like your idea of, you know, who adults are, you know, I think it does kind of force you to lean very heavily on just this group of people who are all brought together largely against their will, who are all, you know, at the same level of maturity, which, you know, when you're talking about 11-year-olds or 12-year-olds is not very. And I think that reinforces a lot of pathologies that are the longer schooling, you know, public schooling remains a thing, the more self-reinforcing that gets. One of the things I really wanted to discuss, which is you are a public school abolitionist. So, I guess, first off, you know, can you tell everyone what that means? And I think I would like to start off with sort of what is your vision for the alternative there? Because there are quite a few, you know, young people let's just focus on America. Don't really need to concern ourselves with anywhere else for this conversation, I don't think. But, you know, there's a lot of people who are of schooling age. And so what would you propose be done there? You know, because I think this is one of those things where what makes me somewhat hesitant to get totally on board with school abolition is just I don't know what replaces it. And that's maybe not a good reason, but it's, I think, a positive vision is ultimately necessary if you're going to replace something that's such a fundamental part of society.
My state functions very heavily off of homeschool subsidization, private schools, charter schools, and correspondence schools. I don't know for sure, but I believe the statistic is only about half the students in my state actually go to public school.
Well, do you mind if I ask what state, or if you don't want to reveal that, that's also fine.
Well, yeah, it's kind of an open secret, I guess. So I live in Alaska. So,
oh wow.
Yeah, up here we have the geographic necessity of public school cannot be the primary solution. That's true for a lot of places up in the north of the world. And my thinking is, if it works here, there's no reason it can't work anywhere else. We do it because of geography and climate, but you can do it without those things. It's not like this makes it possible. It just makes it necessary. So what I would like to see more of, like, my ideal world is basically take this situation and get rid of the public school element, where the government doesn't manage or run the schools at all. They can do they can still collect property taxes for education. And it's actually more efficient this way, because in my region, you can get a check that helps pay for your homeschooling curriculum programs. And, you know, that's one of the ways we can do the private classes thing. And what it does is it takes the per capita per student funding and just redirects it directly towards the family. And the reason I know this is more efficient is because in the way the students receive money, I'm getting back the same amount that I would be paying in property taxes anyway. So that's a one-to-one ratio versus normally what happens is you're collecting much less money than you're actually spending per student in the public school system. So that's one financial aspect of why I think this is superior. The other is a lot of the pros of homeschooling are really just the pro of not being in public school. It is more of an issue that public school does so much harm that getting rid of it at this point, I think, is kind of a civilizational necessity. It is too fundamentally broken to actually reform in any meaningful way. So one is the kind of the factory system of the classroom. And a lot of people propose various like Montessori type solutions, like, oh, we can just reorient the classroom. Like that's not going to work, because the problem is you're still taking in 30 kids, all of the same age, into these classrooms where they're mostly having an influence on each other. And then you say, well, the solution then is better teacher to student ratios. Well, one, that's going to cost significantly more. And two, you got to keep in mind the quality of who is becoming teachers. Like, this isn't a thing that can be solved by spending more money, because you can pay teachers a very large amount of money. The problem is your primary applicant pool is going to be people who have some great desire to be around children or great desire to impart their beliefs onto others. So I love teaching. Why? Because I love teaching people how to view the world similar to how I do. Of course we do. That's what teaching is. I don't want that industry being filled by a bunch of women who went to public universities to be crammed full of the same information that made them think they should vote for Joe Biden. Like, that's a major problem of the selection of who is working in public schools. And as of right now, that problem applies to private schools as well, which is why I don't say they're the solution. Because, say, your local Catholic school, cannot, under current law, discriminate on the basis of religion and who they hire unless they fulfill a very specific function. Most teachers at Catholic schools do not fulfill that function. That is why you have Catholic schools that have a bunch of non-Catholic teachers, because they can't discriminate against them in hiring. And if they try to, one, they open themselves up to lawsuit, and two, they shrink the applicant pool, because educated Catholics don't want to go become teachers, by and large. That's just not what they're interested in doing. Now, obviously, there are going to be some. That's why we are able to have Catholic schools at all. But in the American system, even something as theoretically restrictive in selection of students and teachers as a Catholic religious school still is not nearly as selective in either of those places as you think they are. And so that's why private school is not really the solution. If you abolish the public school system, one of the things that you accomplish is changing the industry of who is in education. Because I suspect, my hypothesis is that the majority of people who want to go become teachers are either women with very strong maternal complexes that they want to be around children, which is great. Great that we can find a way to put that to use for society. That is genuinely good. But otherwise, you have a significant portion of people who don't know how to survive outside of a schoolhouse. They go to high school, they spend their whole life in the public school system, they go to college, they go to university, and they go right back to teaching. They never set foot outside of school in their life. This significantly affects how they view things, how they teach things, and it also significantly impairs their ability to actually know anything, which I think is a big part of why teachers' unions and their political objectives are always so kind of absurd and disconnected from the rest of the country. So that's just one example of what happens if you abolish public schools. Another is you start separating children to be around peers of different age groups. Prior to about the 1960s, most children did not spend nearly as much of their time surrounded by people the same age as them. They were always around very diverse age groups, which allowed them to learn how to be adults. When we talk about, like, 13-year-olds used to be considered grown men, which, you know, does sound kind of alien at this point, but it wasn't because it was just, here, kid, take a shovel, get in the mine. Like, it was they were actually more mature because they were modeling other men. They weren't just modeling other boys who were going about blindly trying to figure things out. So that's another aspect of what you fix by getting rid of public schools and breaking up that group of thing. And those are probably the two biggest. For the impact on society, the pool of teachers we have filling the pool of students that we have with their ideology and their interpretation of facts and data points, if they even know them at all, we have to destroy that system. It's causing so much harm.
Are you familiar with Ivan Illich?
I can't say so off the top of my head.
Ooh, okay. Book recommendation, Deschooling Society by Ivan Illich. He was a Catholic priest. I think he was writing this in the mid to late 70s. He touches kind of on your first point there. The thrust of the book is that schooling is ultimately detrimental to society, in part, you know, because of, you know, of who it selects for teachers. But I think related to that is you know, something that I think once it's spelled out, it's really hard to unsee. And it's that schooling sort of exists to perpetuate itself. Like, as the belief in schooling, you know, that like you can't be a functioning, well-educated adult unless you have gone through some kind of like formalized schooling, preferably, you know, one that's publicly run. And you know, what it does, you know, particularly like once you get up into, you know, the higher levels of education, is it really ingrains into people, you know, who become teachers that this is the only way to learn. And so it creates a dependence on schooling as a process, and on, you know, teachers, you know, who manage that process. And it creates just this society-wide blindness to any other way of being. The way he kind of describes it is it's a ritual that lasts like a dozen years, and none of the participants have any idea that it's a ritual. And that's what gives it such power over the people who partake in it. I think you're right that, you know, ultimately our society is going to have to figure out some way to kind of break that machine, or things are just going to get continuously more dysfunctional as time goes on. Because we're already like, what, six or so generations into more or less compulsory schooling, about four or five for nearly universal schooling. And so I don't think there's anyone alive who remembers, you know, a time before that. And so it's in that time, it's very radically altered how society approaches education.
Yeah, I think it creates hive minds. Like, when we see all the various hive minds that have formed in society, I think public school kind of trains people to think that way, because you've got one teacher who leads a group of 20, 30 students, depending on the age range, sometimes even more, depending on the school. And it creates a sort of cult or anti-cult thing. Either the students love the teacher and eat up everything they say, or they hate the teacher and basically tune them out or come to believe the opposite of whatever they say. Then you have the peer reinforcement thing, where you, like, public school, let's be real, unless you peaked in high school, you know that public school from K through 12 is a nightmare social experience. You're talking, even if you weren't specifically like bullied the entire time, you probably have at least one traumatic social experience from those years that would not have existed if you did not go to public school. Like, that is a universal experience. The only people I have found that can genuinely say that's not true are the kind of people who peaked in high school because they were captain of the football or cheerleading squad.
Even a lot of those guys, still had those experiences.
It trains people to create a peer consensus, which is another way the school feminizes people. And one of the ways public school feminizes people is that almost everybody involved in the administration of it is a female. I don't know it off the top of my head, but I know the male to female teacher ratio is extremely lopsided. And it gets even worse if you start looking into administrative support as well to the school.
Oh yeah. At my high school, I think there were two male teachers out of however many dozens there were.
And then the males you do have, because of the selection problem with teachers, those males don't tend to be of the highest quality. They can be. You can have exceptions, but by and large, I'd say the ratio of males in public school to healthy males is also very lopsided. So you have the direct feminization of students just being surrounded by and led by females constantly this whole time. But then you have the systemic feminization, the development of peer consensus, which is a large part of how females navigate life, because females are very biologically vulnerable compared to males in numerous different ways. And so for safety, their thing is social networks, which is why they're so socially involved. That you can kind of think of it as every woman is a spider in a web, and that web is constantly vibrating, giving her, vibes about what's going on around her. That's how women, by and large, navigate life, is through those kind of social networks and the vibes they get from them. And so you start training males to think that way, too, when you put them in these environments that you're surrounded so much by a peer hive mind that if you step on the wrong side of it, people talk about being Twitter's enemy of the day, but that's a daily experience of public school. The whole cancel culture thing is just a public school coming online, really. That's how people, I hate to use the word bully because I feel like that does not convey properly what I'm talking about because of the image people have with that, but it more or less bullies them into adhering to whatever zeitgeist has control of the high mind at the time. And you can't train somebody from barely being able to read to the age of adulthood and almost mental maturity and expect that not to stick with how they behave all the time for the rest of their life. And so I think that's a big contributor to why we have such a feminized population and all of these various hive minds. So now you have, politics got taken over from 2014 to 2022 by the Tumblr hive mind. Everybody who's online now knows about the Reddit hive mind. Unless you're part of it, then for somehow you don't think it exists. I don't get that, but everybody is checking their tribes. Do my beliefs vibe with my tribe? Am I part of the right tribe? What is my tribe thinking now? And that's not the way men used to think. You don't see 18th century men doing that.
I think sort of in line with that is my own experience in second grade, having my parents be pulled aside at some point and said hey, we want to put your kid on Ritalin, because he's got ADD, or I guess they call it ADHD now. I've talked with my parents about this, so I don't blame them or anything, because they were, naive is maybe too strong of a word, but I think they were maybe just a little bit overly trusting in this regard. But I think ultimately what it was is just that I was a 7-year-old boy doing 7-year-old boy things, who was forced to be in an environment that does not like 7-year-old boys. So you get kind of that, you know, round peg in a square hole effect. And it's, yeah, I think when you have over a decade of that experience, it changes people at a very fundamental way. And in terms of how they relate to other people and how they conceive of themselves and how they form relationships and work with other people, you know, it's in a lot of ways, it's not healthy. I think if you look at, you know, like a graph of, you know, incidences of like, you know, suicidal ideation amongst teenagers, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence that there's a lot more of that now than there used to be. And I think a large part of that was or is because of, you know, the kind of environment that we force kids to be in that seeks to shave off the rough edges of their personality and make them be the kind of person who just sits in a chair for 7 or 8 hours a day and does repetitive tasks. Yeah, I think it's a, you know, there's a long litany of reasons why, you know, I think it's ultimately psychologically damaging, but you've definitely touched on some of the more fundamental ones.
The school system really does hate boys, and not just in a conscious, like, we don't like boys being boys kind of way, but that the system is designed in a way incompatible with natural boy behavior. As you were saying, like, what gets diagnosed as ADD and ADHD is actually just typical normal boy behavior. Like, we're crazy, we explore, we break things, we smash things, we want to learn how stuff works, we are, like, biologically designed to be capable of great violence, and those muscles have to be exercised, and the way we exercise them is by destroying stuff outside, like trees and bushes and rocks and, you know, icicles, and we take things apart, we want to see how they work, we want to know if we can put them back together, because that's how we learn about the world, that's how we learn to make things, and that's just normal. You can't do that in a public school, because it's disruptive and destructive, and you know, you're breaking all the school stuff. You're distracting from the lesson because you're a little boy. You're not supposed to be out in the field frolicking around for 6 hours a day like we always were. You're supposed to sit down in the desk for 8 hours a day doing this paperwork that is on a subject that doesn't interest you at all, because it's not like a little boy doesn't give a damn about division, which maybe he needs to learn it. But you can find a way to teach him in an environment that actually works. Teach him to do it with his food. That's how you motivate a young boy. Don't do it forcing him to sit in a assembly line of alleged knowledge cramming. But then you also have just the co-ed thing in general. The co-ed environment. That's another aspect of the public school environment that just did not exist before, like, about 1960 or so, that boys and girls never spent this much time together. And this is, I think, a very regressive thing that we have forced them to be so close to each other, especially with birth control added to the mix. But let's just take an environment in elementary school for a moment. You have these kids who are just kind of just learning to model social stuff. And I know from, like, having two kids reaching beyond the point of, like, self-actualization and personality development at this point, that, like, kids are still very much forming their personality in these young years. Like, that they are modeling what they see, trying things on for size, seeing what works for them. And when you put a bunch of boys and girls to do that together, they're going to start modeling each other. And so you end up with a lot of females adopting what they think masculine traits are, but they don't understand it properly because they're not actually built for it. And that's how we get the girl boss and the abrasive lady that nobody likes to work with. And then you have males kind of doing the same thing, that we start becoming more agreeable because that's what the females are like. And we start trying to avoid conflict because our female counterparts don't like conflict. We start changing how we play and how we talk to each other. And then you start getting to the age of maturity and pubescence, where we start developing tastes for each other. and you have boys that they don't understand what girls like. They just understand that they like girls and they want to be what the girl desires. Well, I want to be attractive. What is attractive? Well, femininity is attractive. So I'm going to become feminine because that's what's attractive. No, dummy. That's not what girls find attractive. That's what you find attractive. But you never learn that as a child because one, nobody's teaching you that. And two, you're modeling the wrong things and interacting with the wrong people. If males were growing up modeling each other at various ages, they would naturally be developing into a more masculine entity, which females naturally find more attractive. And same thing in reverse. The females would be doing the same thing. I think a big portion of our Gen Z and Gen Alpha's dating crisis is this, that males and females are modeling what they find attractive, trying to pursue what they find attractive, because they don't understand that it's the opposite. I think this is also a big part of what fuels the whole LGBT thing across public schools, is this kind of Frankenstein co-ed socialization that's going on. And then I've written about it. I don't want to go completely off the rails down this subject, but you throw birth control into the mix in high school, and you start really breaking human biology. The normal controlling mechanisms of our species cease functioning properly. I think even aside from the fact that it's dominated by female teachers and administrators, aside from the feminized social consensus pressures, you have a general incompatibility with the young male biology, with the public school environment.
I kind of wanted to take it back to something you mentioned a minute ago, which was a lot of teachers don't really have experience, you know, outside of the classroom. Because that's, I think, is something that I noticed when I was in school, was that the teachers that I had that were actually good at their job, you know, all had private industry experience before becoming a teacher. You know, particularly thinking of my computer science teacher in high school, you know, he worked as a programmer before deciding to become a teacher. I'm curious, particularly when it comes to homeschooling, do you think that there's any kind of correlation between a parent's ability to be an effective homeschooler and their profession? Obviously, you know, you're going to have, you know, one parent most likely who stays at home and does most of the schooling, but you know, I'm curious kind of how do you get around a similar, almost mirrored problem, you know, where, you know, maybe you haven't, you know, that parent hasn't had, you know, real experience out in the world besides being a parent, which is definitely, like, you know, a very important real experience, but is maybe not necessarily relevant to the subjects at hand.
I think it can, and I'll say I absolutely agree with your experience. That's my experience as well. All of the best teachers I had field or industry experience. All of the ones I hated had done nothing but school their whole lives. I think it can, but I'd say less importantly than a person's career or their line of work is their ability to accurately inventory what they know and don't know. That is probably the biggest dictator of whether someone is going to be a good homeschool parent. You have to have an honest assessment of what you don't know. I can teach some very basic principles of chemistry. I can kind of teach you a little bit about, you know, acid and base reactions, you know, the water cycle, that kind of thing. But if we start getting into, you know, how do you synthesize, you know, hydrofluoric acid or something, I have no idea. No idea. I'm not going to pretend to know. Advanced mathematics, if I'm trying to build something, I can probably figure out the math necessary to build it. But if you're doing stuff on paper and talking about math, just, you know, in abstraction, I'm not going to be able to keep up. I can't do it. I didn't go to law school because I was good at math, you know? That's a thing you have to know. You have to know what you don't know. But you don't have to be absolutely brilliant at everything. My wife is a smart lady, so I don't want to carry the wrong message here. She's not an idiot. She's quite intelligent. But it's no secret that I'm the intellectual heavyweight in the house. I'm not the primary teacher. She gets by just fine. I'm there to supplement, really. She knows what she knows and what she doesn't know, and she will get curriculum for what she does not know. We will find YouTube channels or websites, library books, library programs, homeschool co-op-like programs. Like I said, we aren't actually a member of a co-op, but you can still find things similar that you can join in on. So you have to know what you need to outsource. And yeah, for some people, that's going to be a lot. Like, there's no harm in being a simple person trying to homeschool your kids. I will say, Ben Carson's mother could not read, and she homeschooled him. So that is my anecdote of anybody can do this if you put your mind to it. You just have to have a realistic understanding of what you do and don't know, and know how to find people who do. And that's where, if I were to kind of spell out, you know, every little line of a post-public school society, one of them is probably going to be stronger local communities and stronger extended non-nuclear families, because you should be able to rely on your brothers, sisters, parents, aunts, uncles to all help raise each other's kids. That's how we lived since time immemorial. And that really only changed around the 1950s with the creation of Levittown and the suburb and the nuclear family. That is something that people could lean on a lot more to help themselves with homeschooling than I think people do today.
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting answer. It's going to give me a lot to think about. Why aren't you a member of any homeschool co-ops? Is that just a practical thing where you haven't felt the need for it? Or are they just, you have the ones that are near you don't feel are particularly good? Or is that more of a commitment to doing it yourself?
Kind of. I'd say it's more of a control issue than anything else. So where we lived when we started doing homeschooling had, I would say, for a blue state, pretty good homeschool laws. They had, I think there were like three different ways to go about it. And the big one a lot of people do is they go to co-ops or umbrellas. And I didn't like that, because co-ops and umbrellas kind of create your curriculum for you, which kind of sounds like public school with extra steps and a couple of benefits. Like, it still handles the social stuff pretty well, but as far as the actual education, it kind of just seems like a half measure. And then the other way was basically you teach your kids whatever you want, provide proof you're at least hitting a couple core subjects, and you're good. So we went with that route, and we kind of just kept doing that because it gives us more of a ability to pick and choose every little thing that we want to do. I will say there are other states I know that subsidize homeschool that come with more controls on what you can and can't do with that money than my state. So bottom line, everyone looking into it, you need to seriously look at your home state law, state's homeschool laws. I would recommend HSLDA. They have a great website for it. And also, if you're going to homeschool in a state that's even remotely hostile to homeschool, it's probably worth the money to sign up for their membership, because you sign up as a member and they actually will provide legal defense for any homeschool issues you run into. So I endorse them as an organization. They do a lot of really good work, and they're, I think, a great organization for what they do. But you've got to look at your state's homeschool laws, because they vary so much. Some of them will require you to be in some sort of co-op or umbrella. They might not call it that, but that'll be the effect of it. If a state subsidizes it, good chance they're going to require you to be some sort of umbrella or co-op. And that's why in those states, you don't necessarily want to take their money, because it comes with restrictions. But it varies a ton. And my family was such that we decided where to live in large part based on homeschool laws. Because again, it's what you want and how bad you want it. That's how bad we wanted this. So not everybody's willing to do that.
What are some of the states with not great homeschooling laws? So Alaska is, you know, on the better end, but where's like a no-go for you?
Surprisingly, Florida really sucks.
Really?
Yeah, it's bizarre because they seem like a state that would be very good on that stuff, but they actually, they've had a long history of very heavy involvement in the education system. Like, they have very high education taxes. They pour a lot of money into it. Now, I will say it's been several years since I've looked at it, and there's been a lot of changes in the law since COVID. So maybe they've gotten better under DeSantis. It's totally possible. But I remember as recently as like 2021, they were pretty bad. Massachusetts is basically impossible. I will never live in the state of Massachusetts. Alabama is one that I remember off the top of my head as being kind of interesting because it's one that theoretically doesn't have much regulation, but actually if they decided to ever enforce the laws they have on the books, homeschooling is almost illegal, but they don't actually enforce any of those laws. So it's kind of a at your own risk kind of thing. Again, check if it's been updated. HSLDA, they keep track of all this on a very beautiful website with color coding and everything. And they keep track of the changes. I do not keep up with the tracking the changes. So it's very possible some of these states have changed things in the past couple of years as homeschooling has exploded.
I'll have to check out what the current status is in Texas because I have no idea.
I remember Texas being one of the better ones that they had.
That's
very little at the time.
I'm not terribly surprised. I think there's a lot of things about Texas that are not great, but usually on stuff like that, we tend to be pretty good.
I'll say one of the interesting things about homeschool laws is that while it's mostly along red and blue state lines, it's not entirely. Illinois is an example of a very blue state that actually has pretty good homeschool laws. And then Florida, like I said, caveat, maybe they changed it under DeSantis, but before DeSantis, despite being a pretty largely conservative state, they were awful. If I remember right, New York was in the middle of developing even more restrictive laws around the time that homeschooling started becoming more popular. So that's probably another one that I would avoid.
That's not terribly surprising there.
Even if you're not homeschooling, these laws make a pretty good litmus test for what kind of state you would want to live in my opinion. Because if a state feels it is their duty to get into the home and control what a parent does with their child, I think that gives you a very strong sense of whether that state actually is, you know, pro-family and pro-freedom, or if it's a nanny state that wants to make sure all of its citizens grow up to be a certain way.
Yeah, yeah. Recently in Texas, we actually passed a constitutional amendment that says that parents have the right to raise their children, more or less. Kind of crazy that that even needs to be said, but I think there's enough people who felt that, you know, we need to spell this out. And the way Texas does things is a little weird because pretty much everything that's important ends up having to be tacked onto the Constitution of the state. So the Constitution has like hundreds of amendments to it. It's kind of a weird situation there. But I was pretty happy to see that passed. Oh, it is, yeah. I know in our case it has to do with like how like the governor, something about the governor during Reconstruction, or I don't know. It's been a long time since I was in a public school and did Texas history.
Yeah, it's, I think it is more common among the southern states because of Reconstruction and the whole readmission to the Union thing. But like Alabama, last I heard, it's been like 10 years since I checked, but they had their constitution was the longest governing document in the world, longer than the Constitution of India, because they had 900 amendments or something to that effect.
Wow. Yeah, I don't think we're up to that many here. Well, we are a little bit over an hour here, which is right about where I like to get things. So I guess before we head off, is there anything you'd like to promote or anything you'd like to direct us to? Obviously, I will include in the show notes a link to what was the name of that organization again?
HSLDA, Homeschool Legal Defense Association, I believe is what it stands for.
All right.
So if you just look up like Homeschool Legal Association, you'll probably find it. Otherwise, that acronym, you'll find it. Actually, if you just Google homeschool laws by state, it'll probably be the top result.
Okay. Is there anything else that you'd like to promote or anything that you're doing that you want the listeners to be aware of?
Well, we didn't talk about this aspect of it, and that's totally fine because it kind of gets out of the scope a bit. But there's a lot of legal argumentation I've made before for why homeschooling is not expedient as a parent regarding the responsibility schools have to your children and their safety. So I would suggest if you want to try to find that on my Twitter feed, it's probably in my highlights, but if you want to just look it up yourself, I'd suggest people look into the cases of DR by LR, the Middlebucks Area Vocational School, and then Morrow v. Belaski. Those are two linchpin cases. You could also look at, I believe it's DeShaney v. Vago. I'm not 100% on that one's name, but I think that's right. DeShaney should definitely get you there. There is a lot of jurisprudence on the fact that schools basically have no responsibility whatsoever to keep your kids safe under the federal constitution. So that's something else I would consider as far as anybody looking at whether they think homeschooling is a good idea.
Cool. Awesome. I will dig up those cases and link them in the show notes. JT, thank you so much for coming on today. I really appreciate it. This has been a very interesting conversation. It's definitely left me with a lot to think about.
No, thanks for having me. I'm always happy to spread the gospel of homeschooling.